Thank you. So as I said, we're going to do a bit about the paths either later today or tomorrow. So from your handout of weekend two, there is a diagram about paths. So if you haven't got one of those, maybe Jason could help you or something. No, this is not in the book. There is one in the book, which we'll also be looking at. So the one on the book is on page 33. I just wanted to make a bit of a simpler one. So that was in the handout for weekend two. So try to have that ready. But not just yet. I mean, if you're doing the basic program, there isn't a teaching on grounds and paths, which is a bit of an omission, really. But of course, you can't make kind of everything in there. And there isn't a teaching on the 70 topics. You know, you could have an overview of all the 70 topics of the Ornament for Clear Realizations. There is such a course, but I'm not sure it's a great idea to do it, because if you just try to just breeze through the 70 topics without going into much detail on them, it becomes a bit dry. So I'm not particularly recommending that, but you can see why, or that's a reason why I've tried to give an overview of the whole of the ornament, at least the first, the fourth and the eighth chapters, you know, just like as if the fourth chapter is like this fortress, you know, the Zong, or the treasure house, where, you know, you can look forward, you can look back at the earlier chapters and look forward to the end chapters, because everything is somehow contained in, you know, this practice of the fourth chapter, application in complete aspects. All the 173 aspects are there in the fourth chapter, so there's something about them which is about the fourth chapter which does contain all the meaning of the whole text. So, you know, it makes sense, you know, to consider that as a summary of the whole text. But you still need the context of putting it into, you know, the work as a whole, in order to make sort of sense of it. So in the absence of a special teaching on the 70 topics and on the grounds and paths, that's why I'm doing my bits of digression. But that's the way the Ornament for Clear Realizations should be studied, you know. It's impossible to just do every chapter thoroughly, you know. Some chapters, as I say, we never studied at all. Although we studied for 7 years, doesn't mean we studied every chapter. Interestingly enough, like the Knower of Bases chapter 3, and then chapter 7 and 6. You know, we never studied them. I mean, they may be quite short chapters, and not all the chapters not the same length. But you know, you digress. You get onto an interesting subject, then you take that into great detail and debate about, you know, the meaning of this and that, and then you know, you go on to another sort of topic down the line, and you know, you just sort of skim over things. So that's the way to study it. It's not like you have to study each methodically of the 70 topics, kind of, you know, as if they're all of equal importance. They're not. But anyway, we must get down to a closer look at things now. So if you've got the handbook, could you look at page 86 and 87, please? There's a lady without a handbook, Jason. Okay, so the first topic of the fourth chapter is that no aspects of the antidote class. So these are the aspects. These are the things that you meditate on when you are speeding up to, you know, become proficient to get to your state of being a knower of all aspects. You know, the first three chapters, knower of all aspects, exalted knower of all aspects, knower of paths, knower of bases. So that's, you know, the path which leads to the highest enlightenment, you know, knower of all aspects. than the second chapter of Navarapath. So that's what the Bodhisattva's doing, his activities or her activities on the training program. Nara basis is what a person just going to the individual solitary liberation, what they would study. But nobody's encouraging the hearers to do that, particularly in this text. It's like, but the Bodhisattva's got to know all those paths that hearers learn as well, because the Bodhisattva will be hearing, will be teaching hearers, He'll be teaching people who are going to individual liberation. And the hearers and solitary realizers, there's two types of hearer, the hearer and the solitary realizer. So, the Bodhisattva's got to know their paths as well. So he's studying their paths with the extra motivation of bodhicitta, which they don't have, So all those add-ons that a Bodhisattva has when he's studying the hearer paths, they are only studying personal selflessness, But the Bodhisattva realizes everything they realize, but realizes the emptiness of everything they realize. So that's the third chapter, the knower of basis. So then those are the three, main knowers. But then the next four chapters are the applications or the trainings. So how does the Bodhisattva actually train? And the first of the four trainings is training in complete aspects. So that's where you gain mastery, they say. You gain mastery over these 173 aspects. You know what they're about. You hear the teachings, and you get them in sort of sorted out in your mind. They're not just sort of a vague jumble, but you get them, precise. Which ones do you study first? Which ones come later? How do you meditate? How do you transfer from one to the next? So you've got to, be really sort of confident and sort of well versed in them. Then the next one is the peak training? That's when you have gained mastery, So then you have become well versed in them. Then the serial training is the same type of training, but you're speeding up them. The serial training is you've got to meditate through them all in one session. You can go through them so fast one after the other that you can. The serial training, like the name suggests, getting through them one after the other. And then the final training is what the momentary or the instantaneous application. So that's the fourth of these four trainings. So that's the seventh chapter, right? So that's when you can get through all of these 173 aspects in the very shortest time possible, like in a finger snap or something, really rapid meditation through them all. And so when you can do that, in the next moment, you will actually enter the Buddha ground. So then that's the eighth category, Buddhahood, So these fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh chapters, they are your sort of, they're the trainings, you can say. What are you training on? What are you looking at? What are you studying? When you're training, you're studying the 173 aspects. Some of which we've done now. We spent some time on this last week. So if you look at page 86, the first batch of these 173 are the 27 aspects of Nara basis. And not unfamiliar to people who've studied the Four Noble Truths in a bit of detail. And we tried to make a bit of a study of the first ones, impermanent suffering, empty selfless. Those are kind of the four most outstanding of those 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. Usually the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, right? But as we said, in the order for clear realizations, you don't just get four aspects of true paths, you get 27. Why is that? Well, because the last 27 minus 4, the last 23 are paths of the solitary realizer. There's a hearer who goes for solitary liberalization, just meditating on personal selflessness. So the absence of a self-sufficient substantial existence self. But then you've also got the solitary realizer. So those are the people who they're still in the hearer vehicle. They haven't got bodhicitta. They're not going for full Buddhahood. But they have a more extended and sort of profounder path than the hearers. And so those people have these extra aspects. They meditate on basically the mind-only view, right? So that they're not just meditating personal selflessness, absence of a self-sufficient substantial existence self, which the hearer is meditating on, but they're not meditating, or it's not their main object of meditation to meditate on emptiness, absence of true existence, which is what the bodhisattvas are mainly meditating on. That's their ultimate truth of meditation. But the solitary realizers are meditating on mind-only view. Yeah, the absence of different substance. You know, the absence of a difference, no difference of entity between object and subject. Yeah. So everything is just like an appearance to mind, just like the appearances that we have in dreams. You know, like the color red appears to us in a dream. And that's all there is. There's just the appearance to mind. There's no actual externally established red out there. And that's the mind-only understanding of reality. That a waking reality is just like that. Yeah, we have. It seems to exist externally, but that's a kind of a figment of our ignorance. And really, all phenomena are just mere appearances to mind. Just like the appearances of dreams, except a bit more stable, you know, so slightly different rules apply. But that's the nature of reality. When you realize that, then you can let go of all your fuss, you know, all of your attachment and all of your grasping and all of your craving and all of your anger, because you know things are just appearances to your mind rising out of the ripening of your previous, the accumulated karmas. Cool view, huh? So we discussed a little bit last week, so we can't really, you know, go into it now, but certainly questions are very welcome at the appropriate time. So, you know, remember in this school then, which is which school, which point of view are we studying this text from? Yes, Stuart. Yogic, autonomy, middle way school, however you put them in things in different order. But anyway, it's the middle way, so that means it's based on the understanding of the profound teachings of the perfection of wisdom. You know, that's where the middle way view is culled from, that's where it's drawn from. It's definitely middle way view. It's going for, you know, emptiness, not just personal selflessness, but emptiness which covers all phenomena, persons and non-persons. So it's definitely middle way. It's definitely, they'd say, aligned with Nagarjuna's view, you see. So they say, yes, we are followers of Nagarjuna. And then out of the two divisions which sort of came up in India, more or less, you know, emphasized by the Tibetans, the autonomy middle way school and the Prasangika middle way school. So the autonomy middle way school, according to Tsongkhapa and the sort of masters like him, and they're saying that the autonomy middle way school hasn't quite got the sort of refined view of emptiness that really does the business, you know. So that they've still got some subtle clinging to some type of, you know, existence from the objects outside. You know, at a very subtle level which maybe they don't even recognize, you know, but that's what the Prasangika is saying. They don't quite go far enough. There's still some sort of instinct that some things exist from their own side somehow, you know. Whereas the Prasangika view is saying nothing exists from its own side whatsoever, everything's merely imputed by conception, super radical. So this is the autonomy school. And then out of that, there are two branches. There's the yogic autonomy school and the Sautrantika, the sutra follower autonomy school. So sutra follower autonomy school is Bhava Viveka. So it's he's accepting the existence of external objects. Right? So he's middle way, but he's not recognized as one of the Prasangikas. He's recognized as one of the autonomy mode scholars, but in his text he defends the existence of external objects. He's not sort of on the sort of mind-only side. But this text, Ornament for Clear Realizations, is written by Haribhadra, who, remember, is a student of Sankaraksita. And Sankaraksita is credited with devising or, you know, discovering or, you know, upholding the yogic branch of the autonomy middle wayers. Yeah. So they accept the mind-only teaching on absence of external phenomena, but they're also saying, yes, but the mind also is not truly existent. You see, the mind-only school is saying, yes, external phenomena, just an appearance to your mind, just rising out of karmic kind of, you know, sort of ripenings. But somehow the mind is the be-all and end-all. The mind is where everything meets back to. So everything is guaranteed by you know, the sort of the mind apprehending it. So as if the mind is some sort of special kind of a way of existing which the external phenomena don't have, you know. But the yogic branch of the autonomy, middle way school, they're saying, yeah, okay, it's very clear that there's no externally established phenomena, but we've also got to get rid of clinging to the true existence of the mind. So they're refuting the true existence of the mind. And so they, you know, they're like the middle wayers, refuting true existence, but keeping the mind-only kind of proposition that there's no external reality. So from this point of view, this text is being explained, right? So crucial differences from how the consequentialists or the Prasangas will explain it. So anyway, that just is a digression to remind us that the mind-only view here is taken seriously by this school. You know, if you ask Tsongkhapa, do external phenomena, you know, conventionally exist, you probably say yes, I think, you know. That's Dalai Lama would say that, yeah, that there are external phenomena, you know, merely imputed ones, so you don't get too excited about them. Don't cling on to them, you know. But they're rejecting the mind-only view. Ultimately, the mind-only view was taught for certain students in certain situations, but it shouldn't be taken as a final view. It shouldn't even be taken as correct. So that's not in the picture at the moment because we are following a different school, Shantarakshita and Haribhadra. So Haribhadra writes the ornament. And then the solitary realizers, see, they're specializing the mind-only view. They haven't got the wits or, you know, the great heroic bodhisattva resolve to see everything as lacking true existence, but they do see the emptiness of subject-object being different substance, so they do go all the way to meditate on the mind-only view till you know, they've cleared away all obscurations with that view, so that they can go to their solitary liberation. But kind of, you know, it's they've cleared away some extra obscurations, something beyond the sort of the lesser type of hearers. So those last 23 of the aspects of the true paths are what, especially what these solitary realizers kind of meditate on. Well, it's from it's from 17 to 27, so that's only 10, isn't it? 11. Yeah, out of 15, it's only 11, isn't it? Yeah, thank you. I couldn't count. Yeah, so the last ones, the last 11 out of the 15 true paths, which are part of the 27 aspects of Rupanara bases, those are the ones that have get in there for the solitary realizers. And then we have the aspects of Nara path. So that's as far as we got last week. Last time we met, I mean, last weekend that we met. So now we're on to the... I think we talked about the 36 aspects of Nara Path just very quickly. Just to emphasize that, again, you've just got a collection of points about the Four Noble Truths. And you could go into these extra points that they make and kind of... try and, you know, differentiate between them a bit. But if we try to go quickly, the point to make is that beyond what the people in the hearer vehicle are meditating on, they're meditating on yes, and all these aspects are also empty of true existence. Yeah, which is most clearly seen in the 36 aspects of Nara Path, where it says number 5 or 5 of true sufferings. Can you see that in the middle of page 87? So you've got the usual 4 for true sufferings: impermanent, suffering, empty and selfless. But then you've got this extra one, you meditate on everything is being empty of true existence. See what I mean? And it's not just the object that's empty of true existence, you know, the suffering aggregates, you know, the impermanent aggregates, but it's the mind too, the mind also, which is meditating on impermanence, that also is empty of true existence. So it's got to sort of reflect back on the mind as well. So it's not just the object that's empty of true existence, but the mind also. So they have this kind of, you know, more profound add-on So we'll leave the 36 aspects of Nara past there, shall we? So then we go on to the 100 and... Or shall we? Yes, we shall. So then we go on to the 110 aspects of Nara of all aspects. So we did... then the first 37 aspects concordant with those existing in hearers. So then you have the four close placements of the mindfulness. That's the first of the... first of this section here, but you know, if you weren't here last weekend, it's a bit confusing because haven't we just done the hearers? Haven't we just done the bodhisattvas? So why are they coming up again? Well, somehow, I'm not able to explain it myself, really. Okay, now we're onto the aspects which are specifically associated with the Nara of all aspects, you know, the exalted Nara of aspects, which is, you know, the Buddha's wisdom. So now we're on the aspects that are, you know, associated with the Buddha's mind. But then we just go back and say, okay, now there are 37 associated, concordant with those existing in hearers, 34 concordant with those existing in bodhisattvas, and 39 uncommon ones that are just unique to the exalted Nara of all aspects. So that's kind of, you know, why do we go back to the hearers again? Why do we go back to the bodhisattvas again? Haven't we just dealt with them? But somehow... It's put like that in this arrangement, so I'm quite sure why, but somehow the other ones can be practiced in full or completely by people on those still on the learner paths, but these 110 last aspects, they only reach their full development, they're only completely, like, fully kind of meditated on perfectly by somebody with the actual perfection of wisdom, who is a Buddha, you know, somebody who actually has got perfect wisdom. So they're the only ones who can actually meditate on even the four close placements of mindfulness with, you know, kind of the highest level possible of involvement or whatever. Yeah, so we had a bit of a meditation on the four close placements of mindfulness last time, so that's very useful. And then, following on from there, we have several groups. So maybe now we should go back to the text where we get a bit of explanation. So where do they come up? So if you'd like to go to page 62. In bold it says that A, 37 aspects of an exalted Nara of all aspects concordant with those existing in hearers. So these are the 37 harmonies of enlightenment, you know, that you'll find these in... books from the Theravada school, you know, these are kind of a familiar grouping for them too. So you can read about them in their texts as well. So the chart at the bottom shows you where they occur on the path, where they begin on the path, you know. Like some of them, you know, are associated with a certain level of the path, some of them, the people on lower levels of the path don't get started on them or don't do them properly until a bit further on in the path. You know, so there's a hierarchy of where you're actually sort of concentrating on or where they become kind of full, you know, more fully powered or something. So early levels of the path you meditate on close placements of mindfulness, sure, but you won't be meditating or you won't be meditating skillfully on something like the eight branches of the Arya path, because that's something you... only becomes like fully operative on the path of meditation or something. So, you know, there's the point at which they sort of kick in, as it were. But can't go into much detail. So then we can just do a little overview of these without sort of going into detail. But if you have any questions, I'm sort of feeling I'm rushing a bit, you know. And if you haven't had time to do much kind of a study of the text on your own, then you'll be sort of a bit stretched, maybe. Any questions? Or is it all fairly straightforward? Pardon? It's kind of a map, yeah. It's sort of a map in the sense that there is a direction to go in, and that some of these things are sort of tackled before other. Some groupings are tackled earlier in the path, and other groupings are sort of seem to come later. But of course, you know, even we who are not even on the path, we're not even on the path of accumulation, still we can do sort of virtual meditations on these things. It's not like we're not allowed to meditate them until we get to a certain point. We can sort of do practice meditations on them now. But yeah, there's a path of progress that we're trying to follow. Yeah. Yeah, so we're kind of looking them up and then trying to do bits of the walk. Yeah, so we're trying to do both. Yeah, the way we're talking now, it is just the wisdom risen from hearing. Say, you know, so we get all the bits sorted out. We know what the words mean, and then we can start to memorize those and remember them and kind of, you know, be conversant with them, just like learning the foreign language. You know, we can develop the wisdom of hearing. So that's all good training. But then the wisdom arisen from contemplation, wisdom arisen from meditation, that's going to come a bit later. Yes. But you can see how the Lamrim has made it all a bit easier, you know. The Lamrim is, again, based on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras as much as anything, at least when you get to the person of great scope, you know. You don't forget about the lower scope or the middling scope. You don't forget about the 16 aspects and the Noble Truths, you know, or just taking refuge, of course not. But you can see how in the Lamrim they've taken the bits that seem most important or most popular, you know, and concentrated those and made them into an easy, a map that's much easier to read, let's say, you know. Here you're dealing with it when it's in a much more complicated form, yeah. But the aim is still the same, you know. It's still to get you to enlightenment. And anything that's in the Lamrim path, it will be found in these great sutras. So there's nothing in the Lamrim path that hasn't been extracted from these great teachings of the Buddha. But they've simplified it. Yeah. There's a lot of divisions and topics here, which, you know, really for the specialist. So we can look at them in the passing and then, you know, say thank you very much. So he's deepening our awareness, but there's no sense that we have to sort of know all these details completely unless we kind of really are, you know, Buddha Bodhisattvas making progress, right? So certainly in the time we've got, we don't have much time to be very methodical. But going on from the close placements of mindfulness, just look at page 64 now. So these are the next groups of topics in the 37 aspects of Anara, of exaltable aspects concordant with those existing in hearers. So it goes up to page 67. No, it goes up to page 68. So just look at those for a minute. Just get an overview of them. So any more questions or comments you'd like to make? Yeah. Yes. Well, that's probably an abbreviated title, isn't it? If you'd like to look at the definition of correct abandonings underneath. The definition of a correct abandoning is an exalted knower of one who has entered the path that is a joyous effort of enthusiasm for discarding the objects of abandonment and adopting the antidote. I guess that's an adoption of an antidote, isn't it? Yeah, I would say that's just an abbreviation, perhaps. In the book by His Holiness, where these 37 are mentioned, he calls them the four supreme strivings. That's better, isn't it? So, you know, have to do a bit of research. It's that kind of subject. Compare what other people have said. I wouldn't know whether Tibetan is offhand. I could look in the larger commentary, but maybe it's, I haven't really got time. But yeah, so you've got to ferret a few things out here. And you can see they're all quite different. They're all kind of virtuous mental factors that have got to come up in your mind, but they're all quite different ones. You know, the one, close placements of mindfulness, that is the mental factor of mindfulness, or the mental factor of wisdom, they say. And then you get onto these four correct abandonings, they're all types of joyous effort, enthusiasm. And then you go to the next one, the four legs of magical emanation. It sounds quite exciting. Bit bizarre, maybe, but they're all concentration, you know, meditative stabilization. And actually, those are just meditative stabilizations. It's not like you're actually emanating anything. It's what you need in order to be able to emanate. And I don't think the main point of them is so that you will be able to emanate these things, like copies of yourself or whatever you can emanate. Anyway, there's loads of magical powers associated with states of concentrated states of mind, aren't there? What does His Holiness say? I'm not an expert on magical powers. Four bases of supernormal power, that's what they're translated as here, instead of the four legs of magical emanation. Four bases of supernormal power. So bases, I think leg is there, it's like base here, it means cause. With these meditative stabilizations that you're actually practicing, they will be the cause, you know, that's what will give you the ability to do your magical feats. You know, like some magical feats are just kind of useful in the world, or, you know, you can get carried away about them, but they're only like advantageous in dealing with the world, whereas the supernormal power you're really after is liberation, of course. So it's not like this is how we get our magical powers. Well, of course, it would be very useful for bodhisattvas, but still the main point is to get enlightened and to know the teachings well enough to be able to teach people. That's what's really going to help them. But worldly supernormal powers include making manifestations of one's body, flying in space, walking on water, passing through walls or mountains, and going under the earth. However, the highest supernormal power is unpolluted liberation of the mind, nirvana. So then, you know, various mental factors which you need to give you the sort of strength of mind to be able to concentrate, you know, for long enough and in order to be able to develop these supernormal, so these meditative stabilizations. So you need things like, you know, aspiration, effort, intention, you know, investigation. You need these sort of mental strengths, you know, in order to be able to, you know, bring about this sort of transformation of your mind from being rather distracted to being very concentrated. So obviously that kind of concentration is kind of a mainstay, a key cause of your progress on the path when it's combined with wisdom and so forth. So those four are to do with the concentration anyway, never mind the actual magical powers you might have, but it's always interesting to talk about magical powers, isn't it? Bit of relief. So that story, like in the Vinaya, where they said that when everybody, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha had two disciples in the, you know, in the sort of non-bodhisattva mode. He had Ananda, and Mudgalyayana. Is that his full name? In Tibetan, they just call him Mogalipu, but Mogalyayana. So that was, and he was the one who was expert in the magical powers, wasn't he? You know any? Yeah, Mogalipu. You heard about him? Oh, well, I thought you might have. You know, you see the Buddha with two disciples looking down, you know, sort of assistant disciples who were like kind of most prominent in his lifetime as people of the Hira discipline, yeah? So anyway, you often see Buddha like that with these two sort of standing attendants. So Mogalipu is one of those. So they said that when people went to his monastery, they always like to arrive in the dark, you know, monks traveling from monastery to monastery in their sort of peripatetic way they used to have. And they used to arrive in the dark, and they always wanted Mogalipu himself to show them to their lodgings, their quarters, where they were going to stay, because he had the magical power of elements, so that he could make his finger glow in the dark. You know, so instead of having torches, which he'd have to light up his finger and show them to the you know, where they were going to sleep for the night, with his lit up finger. It's all these stories. It's, you know, in Indian mythology is full of these stories, isn't it? And I was reading, you know, this story of the Mahabharata, you know, the great Indian epic, which has nothing to do with Buddhism, but it's got full of stories of sages and with magical powers and all this rishis and, you know, sadhus and so forth, which are all very entertaining. And, you know, it's kind of quite inspiring in a way too. So there's this King Pandu who has two beautiful wives. He's the king in the Mahabharata. Ends up in a great war, like the Iliad or something. You know, it ends up in a war, but there's lots of stuff aside from the general kind of battle that takes place. And this king has two beautiful wives, but one day is out hunting in the forest, and he shoots this deer with his arrow. But the deer is copulating. The deer is like, you know, in the middle of engaged. You know. And it's actually not a deer. It's a rishi, a kind of, you know, a sage, who's emanated as a deer for whatever purpose. I didn't get that part of the story. Why he'd done it? So, you know, when he's dying, you know, because the king's shot him with an arrow. So it's not just an emanation of his body where he is here and the emanation's over there. He actually becomes the deer. So if you kill that deer, you kill the sage. Maybe if it's an actual emanation, you could kill the emanation, but the person who emanated that emanation wouldn't be affected, you know. So it's, what's going on has to be investigated. Anyway, so the deer, the sage, as he's dying, he curses the king, you see. He says, right, you know, if you're so cruel-minded a man that you will kill somebody who's in the act of, you know, enjoying that pleasure, then, you know, I curse you so that... next time that you have sex with one of your wives, you'll die. So Pandu is, you know, suitably cautious. So he lives in the forest with his two beautiful wives, but he avoids, you know, They have to live celibately. But one day, I think in the hot season, his wife's gone to the river to bathe early in the morning. And he sees her kind of naked standing in the morning sun, you know, and pouring water over herself or something. So he's overcome by desire. And, you know, he does the act. At which point he dies. So I don't know whether there's a child of the union or not, but it's all part of the great sort of epic of the Mahabharata. So, you know, it's full of that kind of stories and the implications and the working out of karma. So that was to be a question in the Vinaya. You know, you say, so okay, you kill somebody who's emanated as an animal. You know, because if you kill a person, you lose your vows of being a monk or a nun, right? Killing an animal against a vow, but a minor vow. It doesn't mean you have to lose your ordination. But if you kill a human being, then you lose your ordination. Murder, yeah, so, or homicide or something. So the question is it a deer or is it a human being? You know, you shoot the arrow like that king did. I mean, okay, maybe you're not you're a monk, you're not going to go around with a bow and arrow and shoot things, but, you know, you could accidentally kill an animal, couldn't you? Like a vermin, a sort of rat or something in your sleeping quarters, you hit it with something in the dark out of panic or something. I mean, it turns out it's just an emanation that's actually a person, you know. So the question is it, do you break your root vow when you kill that person who's animated, emanated as a deer or a lion or something? But we won't make that the question for your discussion this afternoon, because that's a discussion more restricted to people who need to know the Vinaya very well. It's not nice of you being lay people. We'll leave that one there. But anyway, so that one is concentration, you know, the power of concentration. The next one of the five powers, you see, that's the powers of... there's a batch of different virtuous mental factors. So just to read through them, this is the bottom of the page 65. You've got the power of faith, power of joyous effort, the power of mindfulness, the power of meditative stabilization, and the power of wisdom. So most of those are familiar. The power of mindfulness here is talking about mindfulness, remembering, you know, the Four Noble Truths. But these five actually come up again when we're talking about the path of accumulation. So that's in the sixth topic, so we'll leave those for now. But we will go back to them if we have time. But you can see different mental factors which you need to achieve this incredible goal of Buddhahood. So faith, you know, joyous enthusiasm, and so forth. So again, you know, things that people on the path definitely must practice. We must definitely kind of, you know, encourage ourselves to practice too. So going on from there, five strengths, seven branches of enlightenment, eight branches of Arya paths. So, you know, you could do investigations, meditations on these, fine. You see the different groupings of these are mental factors in different emphases. So you could pick on something there and make kind of a sort of investigation of it and see what what you need, what you have to abandon in order to perfect that particular one and get familiar with them. But we'll move on. Then we've got to stop at 1:45. So I haven't got a lot of time. Anyway, if we can't do everything, we just have to stop where we get to. But the next group is still within the 110 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects, but now there are 34 aspects especially associated with bodhisattvas. So... again, we can just flick through them, really. I'm perhaps not saying very much, because after all, we are still on the first topic of the 11 topics of the complete realization of all aspects. You say we're only in the first topic of the 11 topics of the fourth chapter, so we haven't got very far, have we? But what can we do? So you can see again, we've got these three doors of liberation. They seem to be mainly on the wisdom side. The three paths of antidotes, they're called here. Three paths of antidotes, which turn out to be the three doors of liberation. So that seems to be mainly wisdom. Three paths of emanation. So this is where it mentioned emanation before, it seemed like more it was just talking about the meditative stabilization, which is the leg of emanation, meaning the cause by which you can produce emanations. So leg in that sense, in this Holmes's book, it just said base. It means, you know, the means by which you can develop your emanations. Here, the three paths of emanation, it seems to be more like actual activities of emanation. But nothing that is particularly sort of easy to cotton onto. So if you look at page 71, and it says the first two paths of emanation, right? So there are three, so the first two paths. They eliminate the obscurations to emanation. So it's not a liberation in the sense of being liberated from samsara. It's you're just liberated from the hindrances to being able to emanate properly. You see, so it's not like it's still a sort of a worldly liberation, not an ultimate liberation. But it's all part of the path, if you know, in the way they're talking about it here. So the obscurations to emanation, so the obstacles that would impede a yogi to manifest as he or she wishes. So the first one, liberation in which that having form views forms. So what that apparently means is, in dependence upon the final concentration, which is, you know, concentration which will be, I think they mean a concentration which is a union of calm abiding, special insight, I'm not sure. Anyway, we haven't got time to delay. A yogi manifests many forms while his own body remains visible to others. So the emanations are sort of separate from his own body. And, you know, that's just the characteristic of that liberation, that ability to emanate. And then the other one, liberation in which that not having form views forms. So in dependence upon a final concentration, the yogi considers herself as formless. So they kind of make themselves invisible, I think, what that means. So as if they possess only the four of the five aggregates, feeling, discrimination, composition, factors, and consciousness. And then they manifest many forms, while their own body is kept invisible. So I think these, emanations, they can be helpful to bodhisattvas. It's a sort of might be a useful extra way in which you can help beings. So they are developing them not just for the pleasure of having them, but, you know, as another means to be useful to other beings if you develop them. But these are general considered to be like just not the main point. You know, the main point is you develop the concentration. Is then you can apply your mind very forcefully to a kind of a virtuous object like bodhicitta, or, you know, emptiness, meditating on emptiness. So that's really why the concentration is actually useful. But it has these other benefits too, if you don't get carried away by just having the power and thinking you're somebody special. Okay, we'll have to pass on now. So five paths of abiding happily in the present life. I wonder what they're all about. Nine supramundane paths. We really have to pass on, you know. We can't stop. That would be a good one to talk about. Maybe we can come back to it if you have time. But then page 74, four paths of abandonment. Again, you know, a bit technical, so I'm not going to dwell on that one. Then we can come to the 10 paths of Buddhas. Okay, bottom of page 75. So this is the last group within the collection of categories here, which are associated with bodhisattvas. So these are, in fact, the 10 perfections. You might be thinking, oh, well, aren't there only 6 perfections? Well, yes, there are. And, you know, that's the common number, the popular number that got carried over into the Lam Rim text, you know. Those are the first 6 of the 10 described here. Those are the ones that have entered the more, you know, popular Buddhist imagination. I'm not saying that they're well known throughout the Buddhist universe, of course not. You know, they are, the practice of the perfections is a bodhisattva practice. You don't find much of it in sort of non-bodhisattva Buddhism. You might find them mentioned, I don't know. I'm not an expert. I'm not saying they're absent, but the people who practice them, and, you know, we're supposed to enter into great joy the practice of the 6 perfections. It's very much practice I'm sure we've all heard about. So, in fact, though, you know, there are, the bodhisattva has 10 grounds of practice. You heard of the 10 grounds of the bodhisattva? Of course you have, some of you. Maybe not all, though. So these are 10 grounds of a, what do we say, a bodhisattva who's realized emptiness directly. You know, so not just any bodhisattva right from the beginning, but the bodhisattva who's reached the path of seeing and is working with direct realization of emptiness. So their progress from the point of having directly realized emptiness onwards divides up into 10 grounds. So if we have time, we can talk about them. I'm hoping to talk about them tomorrow a bit. Grounds and paths, so that's the subject it comes under. You'll find it in the description of, there's the diagrams of the path that are provided in this handbook mention the 10 grounds. The diagram that I made left them out to keep it a bit simpler. So for each of those grounds then, you have a different perfection. Of course we're all trying to in our own way to practice all of the 6 perfections all of the time or whenever we get a chance, right? But there's the way it's organized from the perfection of wisdom literature is that each of those grounds, as you ascend them, you know, you sort of have a surpassing practice of one of the perfections, beginning with generosity and going all the way. Right, so they are arranged in a hierarchy. It is a progress again. But of course, as I say, you know, every bodhisattva is not omitting to do the other practices that are also, you know, there to be done. So we'll just look at them and make our discussion for today on these. So look at them carefully because we're going to be discussing. But I have to do it quickly now, only 5 minutes left. So the 10 paths of Buddhas are the 10 perfections which are successively the focus of practice over the course of the 10 bodhisattva grounds. Although they are termed perfections, Svatantrika Madhyamika maintains that a bodhisattva Arya, superior being, merely engages in the surpassing practice of the 10 perfections, since the actual perfections exist only on the Buddha ground. Yeah, so the perfection of wisdom and all the other perfections, really it's only in the mind of a Buddha. So even on the mind of these high bodhisattvas, it's still like a version, you know, a virtual perfection of wisdom, a trainee perfection of wisdom. Generosity, the intention to give. There are 3 types. Generosity of material objects, generosity of dharma, generosity of protection from fear. In the context of tantra, there's a 4th type, generosity of love. Ethics, the intention to observe or guard. Well, observe or guard morality, I would have thought. Put a guard on your behavior. It can also be defined as the intention to abandon misdeeds. There are 3 types, the ethics of abstaining from non-virtue, the ethics of accumulating virtue, the ethics of benefiting others. Patience, an undisturbed mind. There are again 3 types. The patience of not retaliating to harm, the patience of voluntarily accepting suffering or difficulties, and the patience of definitely bearing phenomena. The patience of definitely bearing phenomena refers to the patience of meditating on emptiness without the fear of losing the self or the fear of phenomena becoming non-existent. Yeah. So joy, effort, delight in virtue. Concentration of mind single-pointedly focused on a virtuous object. Wisdom, that which discriminates phenomena. So all the rest, 7, 8, 9, 10, they are condensed into wisdom. So number 7, skillful means or method. That which issues forth great results with little difficulty. It says that the perfection of skillful means is composed of two groups, inner skillful means and outer skillful means. Really haven't got much time now. Prayer, the wish to accomplish something. Power, the strength gained in order not to be overcome by the discordant classes. Exalted wisdom, that which understands exactly the presentation of the way in which phenomena are posited. Okay, so how many people are we? 4, 8, 12, 13. Four groups of three and one group of four. Is that 13? Yes. So can we divide you up then? This is for the discussion group, yeah? So Jason, Steffi and Jilla. So you three here, Mark's group. Okay. You three here. And four at the back. So we've got four groups. So the first group discusses generosity. You can give examples of the three types of generosity there. And then we want to hear a situation in which you wouldn't be generous, a situation in which it's wrong to be generous. Can you come up with such a situation? Right? So that's generosity is you guys, first group. Second group, you've got to talk about ethics. Again, you've got three types. So you can come up with an example of each of the three. And then, you know, it's can you give an example of which it's wrong to follow the avoidance of the 10 non-virtuous actions? Can you give an example in which it will be correct to do one of the non-virtuous actions? And the next group here is patience. So there are three types of patience. Can you give an example of each one? Can you give a situation which is wrong to be patient? So you would actually be not, you'd abandon patience. Is it possible? Then fourth group, you've got the really difficult task. So it says at the bottom, you know, when these 10 perfections are condensed into 6 perfections, I'm reading at the bottom of this section on page 76, the last paragraph before, you know, the next section starts in bold. The last little paragraph says, when condensed into 6 perfections, the last 4 of these 10 perfections, skillful means prayer, power, and exalted wisdom, are included in the 6th perfection, the perfection of wisdom. So can you say how they're included? How do they all condense down into one perfection of wisdom? Do they fit? How do they fit? Okay, so that's your discussion group. We come back at 2:00, slightly change the timing because we've had to go for early lunch in order to get in there before all the other people come charging in. Is that all right? So I see you back at 2:00, and then we'll go into our discussion groups for 20 minutes, half an hour. Thank you.